7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Cruz.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, good morning, Todd.
Good morning to you, John.
We're off on an adventure today without Greg. He's off to places unknown.
And with that opportunity, we're going to do something we don't usually do. We're going to dive into, this time, Australia, to see if they have any recent or not-so-recent reports that are of interest to us. But before we get to that, you know, John, you were telling me before we started here that we have a lot of requests from our audience to give an update on MH370.
A number of folks would like to have an update on 370. Unfortunately, there's not much to update. They're still keeping a very tight grip. The Malaysians are taking a very tight grip on controlling the accident. So, yeah, you know, there's not much out there. We do know that more and more pieces of debris were found off the coast of Africa. Some portion of which was actually 100% confirmed to be from that airliner. One of the pieces that I thought was interesting was part of the nose landing gear door. It's part of the fuselage that was found and indicated that it was torn off going at a high rate of speed, which would indicate that the airplane may have stalled at altitude and came down, not just glided into the ocean. But in any event, it's not really significant either way. The airplane came to rest wherever it came to rest. A lot of the people, particularly pilots in Australia that have been really focused on this accident, have steadfastly believed that the airplane is 400 miles south of where Malaysia has everybody looking. So, and virtually everybody has said that the airplane most likely went that extra distance. They just don't want to find it, I think. My opinion, they just don't want to find it.
Well, there are folks out there who have deep roots in aviation like us who have opinions as to where this might be, based on the limited facts that we have. And as you know, if you are on the internet at all, even though it's been 11 years since this event, it is still an active source of online traffic, let's put it that way. And I actually had an opportunity to meet one of the people who has a fairly prominent place online with his particular theory of what happened. And all I can say is that he is very, very, very wedded to his theory of what happened, which presumes a lot of things which have no way of being confirmed or denied, including cover-ups from the U.S. intelligence community, secret satellites, and unknown UAPs flying around the aircraft. So whoever's out there putting out that stuff, by all means, any idea is worthwhile. I don't care how outlandish it is. I don't care how little you or I or anyone else believe in it. If you have an idea, put it out there. Is it going to be backed up by the facts? That's the bottom line.
Yeah, it probably won't be backed up by any facts, because they're pretty skimpy. Except the airplane's missing, and it is enough physical evidence now to believe that it crashed in the ocean, not taken away to some place in Russia or some other place. So it's all those people perished in probably a mass murder event. Sooner or later will come. I hope I'm alive long enough to see the outcome of this.
As some of you know from my past statements, I'm not that positive about being found. I think it'll be like the Titanic. Eventually, it will be found. That eventuality might come decades after none of us who are listening to this are going to be alive, but we'll see what happens. In the meantime, the global aviation safety investigative community is giving us endless opportunities to talk about new and different ways that planes crash, and helicopters in the case of what we're talking about today. We're going to take you down to Australia, the Australian Transportation Safety Bureau, which is the NTSB equivalent for Australia, has done quite a lovely job of investigating a number of events. Some of them have elements that would probably happen here in the States. The one we're talking about today is about a crash of a R-22, Robinson 22 helicopter, in late 2023, December 2023 in Australia. This was a helicopter that was being used in a rural area, flying between two fairly large ranches of some sort. And the pilot was someone who was fairly experienced in flying commercially as a helicopter pilot, was certified to fly ranch-related low-altitude flights, and but was not certified to fly at night, nor was the helicopter equipped to fly at night. And let's set up the situation for you. The pilot had flown single occupant from his home to another home to visit with friends or family or what have you. And as night was coming on, he was offered a chance to stay overnight and fly back in the morning. And he decided to go back home. And the report also stated that this was a pilot who had done this before, even though he was someone with thousands of hours of flight experience, did not have much flight experience at night, and certainly was not certified to fly at night, but had flown home in the dark before. This particular night was a clear night. The moon had set roughly 6 minutes before he took off on his final flight, and he was flying back around a little over 20 miles back to his home. This was a fairly flat part of Australia, in northern Australia, so visibility would not have been a problem under normal circumstances. And in fact, gives you a hint as to his usual way of navigating at night. His aircraft was not equipped with an artificial horizon or other equipment that would allow it to fly at night. However, he did call ahead and had the ranch manager turn on the landing lights at the landing pad. Presumably, even though he might have been miles away, he would have been able to see this at night because it's nice and flat and no real obstructions between where he was coming from and where he was going. However, that day there was some controlled burning going on in the area where they were burning some of the brush in the outback for whatever fire control reasons, and there was smoke in the vicinity. It's unclear whether this pilot had done a full, thorough pre-flight and checked the weather briefing and any warnings that were from the area, but there was something published saying that there was a forecast for smoke in the area. The specific area where he lived was not one of the areas that had a forecast for smoke. However, as it turned out, there was a line of fires being set between his departure and arrival point, and he was unable to see the landing pad. He had called several times on the radio, asking if the lights had been turned on, and he said at least on two occasions that he did not see the lights. And there were people on the ground who were about halfway between his departure and arrival who had heard this conversation as well. And so there was a clear record that he was trying to communicate his inability to see where he was going. And as I said before, the moon had set. It was at night. So it was very difficult. And this is something that any pilot who flies at night has to deal with. If you're flying in an area that's dark, that has no reference points, let's say you're out in the country flying over a body of water, or worse yet, there are lights in the distance, let's say on a mountain range and what have you, and you're flying over a fairly dark piece of terrain, and you're looking forward for some sort of horizon indicator, and you think, oh, the horizon is at this particular angle. But it turns out that these lights are on an angle because it's like a mountain range. And you get yourself into a situation where you're not flying straight and level. You think you're flying straight and level. Your inner ear is saying, I'm flying straight and level. But in fact, you're not. And in this case, the pilot eventually hit terrain around 88 knots and unfortunately was killed by the impact. And so the lesson here is, how did this happen? Someone who's very experienced flying this aircraft, very experienced flying in this area, very experienced even flying at night, although he wasn't certified to do so. And yet this was a circumstance where this commercial pilot, with years of experience, flew a perfectly good aircraft into the ground.
You know, how many times have we seen that? Overconfidence. You know, he never should have been out there. He should have gone back before 7 o'clock local time, just because it was getting to be dusk. It's crazy. It's crazy. Why do we have so many pilots? And it's not always the new people. It's not always young and stupid. And we could throw in some old and stupid in there too. In this country, we see it over and over and over again with accidents, where people that they're not qualified, or they think they're qualified to do certain things, and they try to do them and kill themselves. And the ones that really stink are the ones that kill somebody else at the same time.
Now, here is one of these cases where what you preach to us all the time at the end of the show might not have helped this person. Your preaching is do a proper pre-flight, do a proper checklist, prepare before you take off. Let's say this pilot did that. There's nothing mechanically wrong with the aircraft that the ATSB could find, and the aircraft had been equipped with the instruments that were on there. There were no artificial horizons or anything like that. So the aircraft wasn't broken. It was perfectly configured for daytime flying, VFR flying. And assuming that the pilot had read the weather forecast would actually have been a positive for him because the specific area where he was flying to did not have a forecast for smoke. If he went with the assumption, hey, there's no forecast here, and let's assume he did a proper pre-flight, the only thing that was out of sorts here was the fact that he took off at night. And he wasn't allowed to. Your standard checklist is not going to have an item at the bottom saying, hey, check the regulations. And if you happen to be violating the regulations, stay on the ground. So this isn't a checklist issue. It's a judgment issue, like you said a minute ago. It's also a question of overconfidence. If you're a single pilot, especially single occupant, you have no one to fact check you. You have no one to question your judgment. You have no one to say, you know what? That suggestion to stay the night? Let's stay the night instead. I don't want to go with you. No, there was only him in the aircraft.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
What's the best part of this job?
I would say just the amount of knowledge that I've been able to gather kind of about the GA industry in general. In the time that I've worked here, I feel like I've learned so much just from speaking with people on the phone, doing my everyday tasks in my job. We were able to do a ground school with a local CFI, which was super insightful. We lectured about 9 hours. I felt like I've learned so much.
Have you had an opportunity to fly the simulator you have here in the office?
Yes, I flew. I want to say we did at least 2 hours, I think. And then crashed, did some successful takeoffs and landings.
That's a good
the local pattern. So it was very cool to kind of get some insight into what our customers are doing, you know, on a day-to-day basis, the training they're doing.
So with that knowledge, did that give you a better understanding when you're talking to a prospective client?
Absolutely. Yeah,
I know what their needs are.
Yes, I feel a lot more confident speaking to people because I kind of understand where they're coming from, the types of aircraft they're discussing, the types of training that we're discussing in terms of, you know, getting training discounts on there, asking, you know, have you got your private certificate? Have you completed the ground school portion? What have you done? So that's been, I would say, very helpful.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
You know, I was down to Australia towards the end of last year, and we had a discussion with some of the locals about a helicopter flying out in the outback. Apparently, from what they were telling me, it's very common for all these ranches to have these helicopters, and Robinson is one of the more popular ones because of the among the most inexpensive. especially the R-22, which was really designed for training. It's very common to have them out there. All right, so they get familiar with them. They get to use them like they're a pickup truck on the ranch, run them all over the place. And his complacency comes flying in. He's built himself a lot of flight time, right? So he's running all around his property or neighbor property. But, I mean, the helicopter had no lights, nothing to help him at night. You know, with no moon, how do you see the terrain below you? You're going to count on it being flat, and you're going to, you know, fly it at 500 feet.
And those of you watching the video version of this, I'm flashing up a picture of from the report that shows an overhead shot of the area where the crash happened and where the fire was, where the accident site was. And one thing that pretty much is fairly easy to see, there doesn't seem to be much in the way of any kind of settlements there. So if you're at night, you're not going to see any conglomeration of lights. Sure, you might see lights of vehicles driving on the ground, but a moving light like that on the ground isn't going to give you an overall sense of, okay, am I near this geographic area or a different geographic area, or give you a sense of even the opportunity to have a line of lights act as an artificial horizon for you. Again, let's assume here we have a perfectly flat piece of territory, South Texas, where I learned how to fly. If I saw a bunch of lights on the horizon going from left to right, I can be fairly sure that there are no mountains there. So these lights are going to be relatively on the flat ground. I wouldn't recommend using this as your reference point. But if you have nothing else, if you have an instrument failure, or you find yourself in a situation where you're in over your head and you're not, you're flying at night when you shouldn't be, use whatever resources you have to get safely on the ground. In that case, I would have some faith in looking at distant lights on flat territory, which this apparently is as well. However, it's not ideal to do so. It's unreliable for several reasons. And another thing to think about, and this is especially important if you're single pilot flying, your inner ear can fool you. If your head is perfectly still, you have your eyes sort of, you know, going between the instrument panel and the horizon, that's one thing. But let's say you drop a flashlight or drop a pen, and you happen to lean over to pick it up and come back up again. That can cause your inner ear to get confused. You might look outside and think, oh, I'm at this angle, and in fact, you're straight and level, or vice versa. And you might be inclined to feel something in your head, look at the instruments, see that there's a disconnect, and you instinctively either trust your instruments or you trust your body. Well, unless you have instrument failure, it's usually wiser to trust your instruments.
Many people default to trusting their feelings when they should trust the instruments. But this guy didn't even have that benefit because he didn't have any.
And even if he did have instruments that could allow him to fly at night, it's a question of training. It's something one has to overcome. The natural inclination, if you're in clouds or at night or no outside reference points, to rely on what your body's telling you. I'm not saying you have to fight it and it's going to be a big psychological battle, but it can be a subtle sort of thing. It's like, look, default to the instruments. In most cases, you'll be much better off.
You know, if you have instruments. We have no other traffic around, wide open spaces. We have a helicopter that if you ever get in trouble because of the terrain, it's very easy to put it down. If you can see the terrain, helicopter with no lights, other than the red and green, most likely. Right? So he has not, you know, one of the things that a lot of the helicopter guys like to have is some hit that the bright lights aim down so they can see the ground in front of them. And he didn't have the luxury of that, which is crazy for what they do. They should have had lights on it. He's just an accident waiting to happen. Right? With his kind of experience, he just should have was waiting to fill in a date when he was going to kill himself.
Now, the ATSB didn't specifically say what instruments were in the aircraft, but the standard configuration for the R-22 of that vintage, you're going to have an airspeed indicator, you're going to have a vertical speed indicator, you're going to have an altimeter. Those are basic instruments that are not the same as having an artificial horizon or turn and slip indicator, but it's good enough for you to answer basic questions like, am I straight and level? Or am I very likely to be straight and level? Is your vertical speed essentially zero? Is your airspeed steady? Is your engine not revving or not dying, or you know, nice steady sound on the engine? Well, you're starting from straight and level flight. How do you carefully get on the ground? Well, you start reducing your altitude. You got the altimeter. You got the vertical speed indicator. Pick a vertical speed descent rate that's good for you and a forward speed that's good for you, so that if you get close and suddenly you realize you're close to the trees, you're not going so fast that you can't control the final part of the flight. As it turns out, in this case, the authorities estimate that the impact was about 88 knots, which, of course, in a small aircraft like that, striking trees or striking the ground at 88 knots is likely not going to lead to a survivable situation. And this one was not survivable. The pilot was killed.
Number of pilots that do similar things here in the U.S. is a significant number. Do it and get away with it. I see it all the time. We see it with scud running. People who have low ceilings and they fly underneath them, both airplanes and helicopters. You know, pushing it to get to the airport. It's only 5 miles away. I can get under the clouds and get in. Get it home-itis. The lesson here for everybody is the rules are written in somebody's blood. Follow them. Don't follow the person. Follow the rule.
And another related point here, related to a show we did recently, I believe it's going to be the one that came out the week before this one. We basically took the NTSB for task for putting out an incomplete report, a report that didn't address basic questions. Well, this report, in contrast, gave us some additional insight and additional context that's useful for you. In fact, we're going to provide some of this to you on the page supporting this episode. They talked about previous accidents, very similar to this one. R-22, Robinson 22, just like this one, not equipped to operate at night. The pilot was not qualified to fly at night. And there had been two previous crashes in the two previous years. And they have links to that those crashes in this report. And they also have a link to an aviation research report, avoidable accidents, visual flight at night accidents, what you can't see can still hurt you. I haven't read it, but I will make this available to you who are going to the page for the show. And hey, if it has some useful information for you, by all means, use it. If you can find something equivalent at the NTSB or at another civil aviation authority that you trust, read them as well. I guarantee you they're going to tell you something very similar.
Well, that was a good second last word right there. And the last word, and I'll do my standard, but interestingly, before I started, interestingly, the FAA just came out with an expanded checklist for pilots to do after maintenance on their airplane. They're picking up on what we've been saying for the last 200 episodes about pre-flighting your airplane. You have to do a thorough job. So I will state it again for everybody. If you're going to go flying, I don't care what kind of airship you're in, you need to pre-plan it. You should do it twice, once before you get to the airport, once you get to the airport. And if they don't agree, find out why. After you go out to your airplane, do a good pre-flight. I've had a number of people at Oshkosh talk to me about the recommendation that I made to get a mechanic to show you. At least one indicated that's exactly what he did. Right, to get somebody who looks at the airplane, because mechanics look at the airplane different than pilots do. Right, get out there and look at it. Learn what to look for to identify what's missing, like a cotter pin or a nut. Right, and after you get in the air, we're having more and more problems, even with instructor pilots on the airplane. We're having problems with accidents that should not happen. So we're having mid-air collisions and we're having all kinds of other problems, including some with instructor pilots on it. So you really, really got to start paying attention, guys. Right? These problems are not insignificant today. And with that, please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Whether you're a student pilot, CFI, borrowing or building an airplane, or looking to buy, Avemco Insurance Company can help you find the right insurance coverage based on what you fly and how you fly it. No gotchas. No runaround. No confusing language. No middlemen. Avemco Insurance Company values safety and is a proud sponsor of the Flight Safety Detectives podcast. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety today. Earn an automatic 5% off by mentioning you're a Flight Safety Detectives listener.